belonging to as many societies as possible. I may be said to collect clubs, and I have accumulated a vast and fantastic variety of specimens ever since, in my audacious youth, I collected the Athenaeum. At some future day, perhaps, I may tell tales of some of the other bodies to which I have belonged. I will recount the doings of the Dead Man's Shoes Society, that superficially immoral but darkly justifiable communion. I will explain the curious origin of the Cat and Christian, the name of which has been so shamefully misinterpreted, and the world shall know at last why the Institute of Typewriters coalesced with the Red Tulip League. Of the 10 teacups, of course, I dare not say a word. The first of my revelations, at any rate, shall be concerned with the Club of Queer Trades, which, as I have said, was one of this class, one which I was almost bound to come across sooner or later because of my singular hobby. The wild youth of the metropolis call me facetiously the King of Clubs. They also call me the Cherub, in allusion to the roseate and youthful appearance I have presented in my declining years. I only hope the spirits in the better world have as good dinners as I have. But the finding of the Club of Queer Trades has one very curious thing about it. The most curious thing about it is that it was not discovered by me. It was discovered by my friend Basil Grant, a stargazer, a mystic, and a man who scarcely stirred out of his attic. Very few people knew anything of Basil. Not because he was in the least unsociable, for if a man out of the street had walked into his rooms, he would have kept him talking till morning. Few people knew him because, like all poets, he could do without them. He welcomed a human face, as he might welcome a sudden blend of colour in a sunset. But he no more felt the need of going out to parties than he felt the need of altering the sunset clouds. He lived in a queer and comfortable garret in the roofs of Lambeth. He was surrounded by a chaos of things that were in odd contrast to the slums around him. Old fantastic books, swords, armour, the whole dust-hole of romanticism. But his face, amid all these quixotic relics, appeared curiously keen and modern, a powerful, legal face. And no one but I knew who he was. Long ago as it is, everyone remembers the terrible and grotesque scene that occurred in, when one of the most acute and forcible of the English judges suddenly went mad on the bench. I had my own view of that occurrence, but about the facts themselves there is no question at all. For some months, indeed for some years, people had detected something curious in the judge's conduct. He seemed to have lost interest in the law, in which he had been beyond expression brilliant and terrible as a K.C., and to be occupied in giving personal and moral advice to the people concerned. He talked more like a priest or a doctor, and a very outspoken one at that. The first thrill was probably given when he said to a man who had attempted a crime of passion, "I sentence you to 3 years' imprisonment, under the firm and solemn and God-given conviction that what you require is 3 months at the seaside." He accused criminals from the bench not so much of their obvious legal crimes, but of things that had never been heard of in a court of justice, monstrous egoism, lack of humour, and morbidity deliberately encouraged. Things came to a head in that celebrated diamond case in which the Prime Minister himself, that brilliant patrician, had to come forward gracefully and reluctantly to give evidence against his valet. After the detailed life of the household had been thoroughly exhibited, the judge requested the Premier again to step forward, which he did with quiet dignity. The judge then said, in a sudden grating voice, "Get a new soul. That thing's not fit for a dog. Get a new soul." All this, of course, in the eyes of the sagacious, was premonitory of that melancholy and farcical day when his wits actually deserted him in open court. It was a libel case between two very eminent and powerful financiers, against both of whom charges of considerable defalcation were brought.